welcome to another News. I'm Jeff Brady. In this show, we talk about the power of belief systems, and specifically one known as Scientology. L. Ron Hubbard, the creator of Scientology, would have turned 104 this March. Early in his writing career, he was known for his science fiction and fantasy stories. At some point later, Hubbard outlined a metaphysical self-help system called Dianetics. These concepts evolved into a set of rituals and became the foundation for the Church of Scientology. The Church was established in 1954. It was later recognized as a tax-exempt religion in the United States. The Church branched out globally to South America, to South Africa, Australia, Sweden, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Portugal, and Spain. Today, the Church of Scientology continues to launch massive campaigns and recruit new members while amassing billions. Scientology is usually in the media when a celebrity disconnects from the church, or you hear about a former member being stalked and harassed for leaving. Our guest, Tony Ortega, keeps a close eye on the current staff leading the Church of Scientology. He's been writing about it since 1995. He's the executive editor of The Raw Story and formerly the editor of The Village Voice. Tony jokingly calls his website the Underground Bunker, and it can be found at tonyortega.com. We get a fascinating insight into the belief systems within Scientology and talk about the HBO film by Alex Gibney called Going Clear, Scientology in the Prison of Belief. It's based on a book titled Going Clear, Hollywood and the Prison of Belief. Now, interestingly, this interview was conducted in an empty apartment under renovation in an Upper East Side high-rise. Tony, welcome to Another News.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, here we are in almost an underground bunker, and I appreciate you doing this live. It's really cool. Can you tell listeners about yourself and what made you begin to write about Scientology?
Sure. I'm a reporter. I cover a lot of different things, but 20 years ago, I stumbled onto a great story that had Scientology as one of its elements, and it just made me curious for more, and that story led to another, and that story led to another. And over the years, I moved around the country a lot, but I always maintained my sources and kept an eye on what was happening with Scientology. I ended up in New York. I'm originally from L.A. I ended up in New York at the Village Voice right about the time that the Anonymous movement was starting up. And I could see there was a huge interest in Scientology stories. And so that motivated me to look back into what was happening. And I started doing more and more stories. And then in 2011, the story just exploded. For me, that was when Marty Rathbun became the subject of a bizarre intimidation campaign down in Texas. And nobody was covering it. And so here I was in New York covering this day-by-day bizarre story in Texas. I could see that Scientology was definitely something that I could, you know, cover as a daily beat, as, you know, as a blogger. And so I started to do that, and I've been doing that ever since. So I just think Scientology is going through a really fascinating period right now, and I feel like as a reporter who covers it every day, I've got a front row seat.
For listeners who may not know what Scientology is, can you give us a description of that?
Sure. L. Ron Hubbard was a pretty well-known pulp fiction writer in the 30s and 40s, and after World War II, he got interested in the human mind, and in 1950, he came out with a book called Dianetics. He claimed to be the first person in human history to truly understand the nature of the human mind, and he had some interesting theories about the way we absorb memories, particularly traumatic ones, and how a kind of counseling he called auditing would allow you to revisit unpleasant memories in order to lessen their effect. And I definitely think there's something to that. I think if you sit down with somebody that listens carefully and is thoughtful and you get to talk over things that have bothered you in the past, you'll feel better. But Hubbard's ideas really went a lot farther than that. He wanted people to remember what they had experienced in the womb, because he said those were the most traumatic memories that affected your entire life. And the book was incredibly popular, and Dianetics clubs were started around the country, and all these people were getting into pairs and trying to remember what they had gone through in the womb. That kind of died away, and Hubbard went bankrupt, and he actually lost the use of the word Dianetics. So he started over again in Phoenix in 1952, and this time he called his movement Scientology. And by then, it wasn't enough just to go back to the womb. He wanted to remember past lives. He thought that not only were we affected by what had happened to us early in this life, but that the reason why you couldn't speak in front of a group, or why you had arthritis, or why you had a rash, might be related to something that happened to you several million years ago on another planet. Some of his early followers thought this was just outlandish, and he lost them. And that's the subject of the movie The Master, by the way. That moment when he moves into past lives and loses some of his early followers. And Scientology started to gain followers, at least with a certain segment of people who believed in this idea that you could go millions of years into the past and remember whatever it was that happened back then that's bothering you currently. You know, for most people, that's just a very outlandish idea, and Scientology really hasn't appealed to the majority of people, but it's always had a certain following of people that thought it was interesting.
Could you extend that a bit and go into the thetans and, right. and what that's about?
So that's just a basic of what the idea is of the counseling. Going beyond that, Hubbard believed that each of us has a soul that he called a thetan. And this is an immortal being that's lasted for trillions of years. You've existed through countless past lifetimes. You will exist for millions more lifetimes. And that when you first get into Scientology, you're told that you have this part of your mind called the reactive mind, which prevents you from seeing that nature. And it's through counseling and removing the reactive mind and implants left in the millions of years past that you can finally begin to see your true nature. You can see the fact that you're a thetan, and you can see down that what's called the whole track of existence. And you can really re-experience those things from millions of years ago with total clarity. When you get to that point of removing what's called the reactive mind, you become clear. And then you really get a sense of who you are and what you are. Beyond that, you get into what's called the operating thetan levels. Now, when Hubbard first proposed Dianetics in 1950, clear was as high as you could go, and he proposed that it would just take two people talking to each other for hours and hours and hours. But, you know, he also promised powers that if you became clear, you could have total recall, you would be impervious to illness. He really promised becoming superhuman. The problem was people followed his directions, did the counseling, spent hours and hours on it, and passed certain courses and got certain certificates, but they didn't get those superpowers. And so he would add on another level. Well, you need to do this next level, and it's a little bit more expensive and a little bit more expensive. So by the 70s, he tacked on all these extra levels called operating thetan levels, and it was getting quite expensive. Today, to go from the very first course, which costs you no more than $50, up to the highest levels that can cost $1,000 an hour for dozens and dozens of hours of processing, you can spend $500,000 getting through this entire process called the Bridge to Total Freedom. And the problem is you get to the end of it and you still don't get superpowers. So this has been Scientology's big challenge, is how do you hold on to people when you never deliver what you promised? Scientology is not creating people who have perfect recall and are impervious to illness and can affect matter with their minds. And so that's when, in the 60s, Hubbard starts to bring in real control mechanisms, real indoctrination, and what he called ethics. And this is what people really have a problem with, is that Scientology is an interrogation culture, it's a snitching culture, it's all intended to keep you from leaving, even though they never deliver on what they promise. This is one of the main complaints about Scientology.
I'm curious if there are higher-level Scientologists, such as the celebrities, that claim to have those particular powers at the higher levels.
Well, see, this is great. There's so many wonderful things about Scientology culture that you pick up when you really learn it, is that, yeah, why can't, okay, you know, you've gone through OT8, which is the highest possible power, and you're supposed to be able to affect matter with your mind. Well, why not just show people? Why not create a miracle? But see, part of Scientology culture is,
That would be crass. You know, I don't have to prove to you that I can do these things. They put in their magazines little stories about people of performing minor miracles, but they never actually demonstrate it for anybody. And also, Hubbard had built in this idea that you're not supposed to talk about your case with other people, which was really smart because if you're all doing past life memories, everyone's going to remember that they were, Julius Caesar. Everyone's going to remember they were Jesus Christ. Everyone's going to remember they were Napoleon. So Hubbard was very smart to say you cannot compare notes with anybody else. And this way you were able to think that you were all these things and not realize that everybody else thought the same thing.
That's really interesting because I wonder if anyone has any of that data, has any of those notes of the people who...
Well, that's I'm glad you raised that question because this is another thing that separates Scientology from anything else that calls itself a church. When you go into confessional in Catholicism, it's you and one other person, a priest. You talk about the sins that you've done, and it's all verbal. Nothing's written down. There's no record kept of you and your transgressions. Scientology, when you sit down for a session, which can be very confessional, it can be an interrogation, everything is written down. And not just with your auditor, but they have constructed auditing rooms where there's a camera on the person. So it's all videotaped, detailed notes are taken. The Scientologists are asked to give up the most intimate secrets about their lives, their sex lives, their masturbation habits. All of this is written down. And as Marty Rathman explains in the film Going Clear, if there's anything that's said that could be considered a challenge to the church or a problem with the church, that is automatically pulled out of those notes and given to the ethics division. So there's no secrets in Scientology. You get used to being quizzed about your most intimate secrets. And ex-members will tell you that if you leave Scientology and criticize it, suddenly those things that you told to an auditor that were supposed to be in confidence start showing up on the internet. I mean, and this goes back 50 years. There's court documents showing people saying that the things they said supposedly in confidence were later used against them.
There's a structural pattern in similar to Skull and Bones where you go through that particular initiation that has recently been exposed and maybe things like Bohemian Grove. Have you noticed those parallels in other cults?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all high-control groups use the same methods. I'm actually looking into a group that's a Bible-based group, and it surprises me how similar they are. I guess it shouldn't surprise me, but they all use the same methods. The idea of... I'm talking about high-control groups. I'm not talking about mainstream religions. I'm talking about high-control groups. Some people call them cults. I tend not to use that word because it's hard to define. But, the idea that you're getting special knowledge that nobody else has, and once you have that special knowledge, you're not supposed to share it with the outside world. And anything good in your life comes from the group. Anything bad in your life is your fault. You have to be associated with the group if you want things to go well. They all share the same exact tactics. They all have different names for them, but they do all share the same tactics. In Scientology, this idea that every time you sit down with an auditor, you could be giving up these intimate secrets that could later be used against you. I mean, that's just built into Scientology. They all know it. They all expect it. As Mark Headley has told me, there are no secrets in Scientology, and it keeps you from leaving. You don't want them to use it against you. You're ashamed of the things you said. And in the film, Going Clear, this is Alex Gibney and Larry Wright really present this as a theory for why people like John Travolta and Tom Cruise stay in. It's because they have to go through that same process as well. And everything they've said has been written down. One of the more powerful things about Tom Cruise in the film is that, his auditing sessions were recorded. And Marty Rathbun was Tom Cruise's auditor, and he would write down all the notes about all the things Tom was saying about his sex life and everything else. That would be immediately sent to David Miscavige. David Miscavige would then have a copy of all the most intimate things Tom had said. David Miscavige worked very closely with a man named Tom DeVaught. And in the film, DeVaught says that, they would have scotch at the end of the day, and David Miscavige would be laughing, reading from these notes about Tom Cruise's most intimate details. So, there's just, I'm amazed that Tom stays in when this is not new information. This has been known for at least 6 years, and I'm amazed that Tom would still stay with the group when it's been reported that this guy that supposedly worships like a god has betrayed him like that.
The individual that you just mentioned that told that story about Miscavige, you just wrote about him recently.
I just wrote about him. Tom DeVaught just had a very classic Scientology experience. Tom has been out for almost 10 years now. And in 2005, he left. In 2009, he went public with the St. Petersburg Times, is now called the Tampa Bay Times, in a really epic series called The Truth Rundown. And he was one of several former executives that exposed all the violence in Scientology and this prison they have called The Hole. And so he's been the subject of intense surveillance and retaliation for 10 years, including the fact that his sister and his niece and some other family members all disconnected from him. And that's a policy in Scientology that once you run afoul of Scientology, they call it being declared a suppressive person, all other members of Scientology, if they want to remain in good conduct with the church, they have to all disconnect from you, cut off all ties. So Tom has been doing a little bit of exploring on Facebook, and a few days ago, his niece, who he hasn't heard from in 10 years, suddenly friended him. And he immediately realized what the consequences of that were. He messaged her and said, "Give me your phone number, I'm going to call you." She sent him the phone number, he called her, and as soon as he had her on the line, he unfriended her on Facebook. And he said, "Look, you have to understand, I'm under intense surveillance. And they will be watching my Facebook page, and there will be consequences." And his niece said, "No, come on, Uncle Tom, this is just not, I mean, they're not watching that closely." He said, "No, they really are." Sure enough, the next day, he got a text from his niece saying that his mother had been called by the church ethics department saying that, you know, your daughter was seen associating with Tom DeVaught on Facebook, and she's in big trouble. And Tom says what he's really worried about is that, you know, his niece seemed pretty determined to be back in his life. And if she continues to associate with him, her own mother may have to disconnect from her. I mean, her mother, Tom's sister, is still a member of the C organization, and it's a very serious thing. So, I mean, Scientologists face this all the time. You know, you can talk to this person, but you can't talk to this person. If I don't disconnect from this person, I'll lose my standing in the church. It splits up families, brothers and sisters, you know, parents and children. And so Tom DeVaught just went through that this week. I mean, another thing I really like about the movie is that, yes, they're showing you about L. Ron Hubbard in the 50s, and they're telling you about stuff that happened at the international base in the early 2000s. But they bring it right up to the present time to show you that all of these toxic policies are still very much in place.
It's a great term that you use, the toxic disconnect. Our guest is Tony Ortega, the executive editor of The Raw Story and formerly the editor of The Village Voice, and he's been writing about Scientology since 1995, and we're talking about Scientology right now because of the recent film that has come out called Going Clear, based on a book by the same name. Tony, can you give us a profile of a Scientology member?
That's a good question. I mean, they tend to target middle class to upper middle class white Americans. I mean, it's very white church, and they tend to be people that have money. I mean, you have to have money to be in Scientology. The prices are outrageous. If you're in a several years, you will get up to the point where it costs $1,000 an hour for counseling. So, and one of the slogans in Scientology is we make the able more able. So they're not looking for disabled folks. They're not looking for homeless folks. They're not, you know, they want wealthy folks who think they can become superhuman. So it tends to be very white in America. They also, they've lost some countries because of controversy and the internet. It's becoming increasingly difficult for them to recruit in the United States, in Australia, in Europe. In Eastern Europe, they're having some success. Places like Russia, places like Hungary, activity in South America and even Africa. But overall, you know, Scientology is much tinier than people think it is. The celebrities tend to make people think that it's a big, powerful organization, but it's really not. It's gotten maybe 40,000 to 50,000 people worldwide who are active members, even though Scientology says they have more like 8 to 10 million, which is pure fantasy. But I would say your question is a good one. They tend to be middle to upper middle class folks who used to be recruited in college a lot back in the 60s and 70s. Today it's harder to reach those people because college students tend to be very savvy about the internet. So they're not growing right now. They're actually shrinking. And the young people they have tend to be people that grew up in it. But they do still attract some young people. I've written some stories about some young people that have joined and become very involved very quickly. But, you know, in their spiritual headquarters in Clearwater, Florida, we keep hearing that virtually everyone who works there now are Russians. You know, it's getting very hard for them to recruit Americans at this point.
Well, that brings us to that case with Lisa McPherson. And when I was living in Florida, I remember that was a big case. And I had visited the Fort Harrison Hotel. Beautiful, beautiful place. And unfortunately, it's not a hotel. It would be a great hotel if it was. Tell listeners, if you could, about that particular case.
Sure, I'll go through that as quick as I can. Lisa McPherson was a Scientologist from Dallas, attractive young woman who... went to Clearwater because that's where you go if you're real dedicated. She ended up there. She was struggling. She was moving up the bridge. She was trying to become clear, but she was having a nervous breakdown. I don't know how else to put it. And she kept being pushed to get to clear. And it really, you know, sometimes these processes can really be difficult for people. They really kind of put a whammy on you. Jason Begay really explains it pretty well in the movie, but. Anyway, she snapped, basically. She had this episode where she was in a just a fender bender on the road there in Clearwater. And the paramedics arrived, and they were checking to make sure people were okay. And they checked with her, and she seemed to be okay. And so they weren't going to treat her or anything, but they turned around, and she'd gotten out of her car and had stripped naked on the middle of the street. So this was obviously, this woman was obviously going through some kind of a breakdown. And so they put her in the ambulance. They took her to a hospital. And the doctors, you know, pretty understandably called for a psychiatric evaluation. Well, you have to understand, Scientology, there's nothing they hate more than psychiatry. It's their big bugaboo. It's their big Satan. It's the, you know, psychiatrists are responsible for all the evil in the universe, not just the world, right? So some Scientologists showed up at the hospital and said, no, you're not giving her a psychiatric evaluation. We will take responsibility for her. We will take her, the church will take responsibility. So they took her to the Fort Harrison Hotel, which is this jewel, this, you know, center of their spiritual headquarters in Clearwater, Florida. And 17 days later, she was dead. And, you know, there's a lot of question about what happened. L. Ron Hubbard in the 70s had decided he had found the way to deal with psychosis. And that was you take somebody that's having a psychotic break, you lock them up in a room with no stimuli, and except for one person that goes in and tries to communicate, nobody talks to the person. He had this idea that the psychotic person just needed to be kind of alone and with no stimulation. And so they put her in this room. And these caretakers tried to give her food and water, and she was just crazy. I mean, she was fighting with people. She wouldn't clean herself up. She wasn't eating. And literally 17 days later, she died of dehydration. And it was because this introspection rundown is what they call this Scientology process, or Scientologists also call it baby watch. It had just killed her. They didn't give her the proper care that she needed. They rushed her to the hospital. She technically died in the ambulance on the way. Initial autopsy showed that she was just crazy dehydrated, and that was that killed her. And so the state of Florida actually criminally indicted the Church of Scientology. She died in December 1995. It really didn't become public for a whole year later. But by 97, 98, this was a huge public press nightmare for the church. Scientology was indicted criminally. The family of Lisa McPherson filed a civil suit, and Scientology spent millions and millions of dollars trying to influence the prosecutors, the medical officer of the county, and it worked. They eventually put so much pressure on the woman who was the medical examiner of that county, she changed the cause of death and said it wasn't an accident, said it wasn't dehydration. And there's just no question that it was just they pressured her into it. So they got out of the indictment, and then by 2004, they'd gotten out of the civil lawsuit. And there's a lot of repercussions from it. It's too complex for me to go into right now, but there's just so many different repercussions just from that one incident. But, you know, look, this is 20 years. This will be 20 years this year that she died. And, you know, why are we still talking about one person who died 20 years ago? And I think the reason is it really exposed how Scientology has some very bad policies about mental health. And one of the, you know, Janet Reitman did a great job describing this story. And one of the things she pointed out was Scientology doesn't change. L. Ron Hubbard died in 1986. They can't go back and rewrite the introspection rundown. So there's every chance that this could happen again. And that's why the McPherson case is still so important today.
So, Tony, you believe Lisa McPherson's death was a function of some of the protocols of Scientology and not something else, maybe deliberate or sinister?
No, I think it was just applying this introspection rundown. I wrote about another case recently where the introspection rundown also led to some really really bad results. I think they had a woman who needed some serious professional help. They followed Hubbard's instructions and it ended up killing her. I don't think anybody at Scientology intended harm. I don't think they wanted to kill her. I just think they were following really bad, neglectful directions about how to take care of her. After that, Scientology did everything it could to get out of trouble, and they you know, Marty Rathbun has admitted they destroyed documents, and you know, he's also admitted that they spent millions trying to influence judges and prosecutors. All of that is very dirty behavior, very. But I still don't think they intended to kill Lisa McPherson. But it shows that the Scientology concepts about how to treat mental illness are completely flawed. Larry Wright has a great phrase in the movie Going Clear. He said that L. Ron Hubbard's ideas about the human mind and how to treat illness amount to psychological folk art. I think that's just the perfect description. They have these silly non-scientific processes that when you're talking about movie stars doing some questioning of their own souls or whatever, who cares? But when you have somebody with a real illness, a real problem, you can't run these processes on them. You end up with something like McPherson. So it's a cautionary tale about how Scientology is really can cause harm because it has really backwards ideas about the human mind.
Yeah, that case was gigantic in the mid-90s. I remember that. Thanks for going into detail. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Now, Tony, as a historian on Scientology, can you talk about the significance of L. Ron Hubbard's early interactions with members of Aleister Crowley's group and Jack Parsons?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating part of L. Ron Hubbard's history, and Alex Gibney and Larry Wright did a great job in the film illustrating it. When Hubbard finished up with his work with the Navy in World War II, he ended up in Los Angeles, and he was kind of wandering. He was looking for something to do, and a friend of his introduced him to a man named Jack Parsons. Jack Parsons is a really fascinating guy in his own right. He was one of the founders of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He was associated with Caltech. He was a rocket engineer. But he also had this really interesting side where he was fascinated by the occult. And he had this very large house in Pasadena. He was from a wealthy family. And he would only rent out the rooms to other eccentrics. So there was the house was full of artists and, you know, people that also shared his fascination with the strange and the unusual and the occult. In particular, he was interested in the ideas of a man in England named Aleister Crowley, who had a particular set of occult ideas about sex magic, about one of the guiding principles of his books was the idea that do what thou wilt is the only law. I mean, you know, just basically, you know, cast off these ancient ideas about right and wrong. And it was a real kind of freeing thing for some people at that time, especially if you can think back to how repressive some society was at that time. But, you know, Parsons really took it seriously. And so Hubbard shows up at the house and they kind of hit it off, but Hubbard almost immediately stole Parsons' girlfriend away from him. Parsons had been seeing a woman named Sarah Northrup, and Hubbard stole her away, even though Hubbard's wife was still living up in Washington. He was married at the time. And so he stole Sarah away, And but he was still very much into Parsons' ideas about sex magic and rituals. Parsons then found a woman named Marjorie Cameron, this striking redheaded woman, who was also interested in these ideas. And so Parsons, Hubbard, and Marjorie Cameron started performing these rituals in 1946, a whole series of sex magic rituals that Parsons, I guess his idea was to get Marjorie pregnant with the moon child that would become some kind of antichrist on Earth, okay? So if you can imagine, it's 1986, they're wearing robes, they've got wizard caps on, they're enchanting things, and they've got candles going, and you know, Parsons is having sex with Marjorie while Hubbard is taking notes in some way. He was the scribe. A whole mind-blowing scene, right? And good for them. They're having a good time. It's great. But see, what's really fascinating is if you look at the rituals they were doing and you look at Crowley's ideas, a lot of that ended up in Scientology.
Did you uncover specific evidence of Aleister Crowley's occult work in Scientology?
You know, I really have to defer to Ohio State University, Hugh Urban. He did the real hard work on this. He did great stuff. John Atek as well, historian in England. Hugh Urban released a study 2 or 3 years ago where he shows point by point how ideas from Crowley and his particular ideas end up in Scientology. I mean, just for one little basic thing was levels all start not at 1, 2, 3, but always 0, 1, 2, 3. I mean, little things, little connections that show the parallels. But also this idea that you become superhuman. You know, if you go through a certain talking ritual and answering questions and asking questions and answering questions, that you would attain these powers. So if you type in Scientology occult Village Voice, you'll find the story I did about Hugh Urban's study. It's really fascinating stuff.
Tony, you've done a lot of journalism on this area, particularly of Scientology's tax-exempt status under U.S. law. Can you tell listeners about what you've uncovered in this particular area?
Well, I mean, there's been great journalists before me that did amazing work at the New York Times and Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. I'd done some of that myself. I interviewed a previous IRS commissioner who went through some of the harassment, and it's a really interesting story. Basically, Hubbard was making some money and making health claims early on, and that ran him afoul of the government. The government doesn't, you know, at least back then in the 50s, the FDA was more active, and they didn't like the fact that he was, you know, making all these claims that if you do the processing, you'd be impervious to illness. And so he started running into these government problems. And so in 1953, we have this letter he wrote to a follower saying, let's try the religion angle. I mean, it was literally that cynical, you know. Let's just call ourselves a religion. That way the government can't, you know, tell us what to do. He was able to get tax-exempt status fairly early on, up to about 1967. And the IRS just said, look, this is a business. It's not a church. It's all benefiting Hubbard. He's making millions of dollars. This is not the way a church is supposed to work. And in 1967, they took tax exemption away from him. Hubbard was unhappy about that, and so he just refused to pay his taxes. It's ever since then. And so by the 80s, when he had died, this was becoming a problem. Because as we got up to the early 90s, as Marty Rathman explained, Scientology owed $1 billion plus in taxes. And they only had about $250 million in assets. So they had to get tax-exempt status or they were dead. And so, you know, David Miscavige and Marty Rathbun, these top leaders at the time who had replaced L. Ron Hubbard, just to say that, you know, I mean, you know, there are various strategies you could do to try to get tax-exempt status. They decided the best thing was to go to war with the IRS. And that's what they did for years. They filed thousands of lawsuits. Individual Scientologists sued individual IRS employees. They had IRS employees followed and harassed. And I talked to an IRS commissioner whose home was bugged, who, you know, would get calls in the middle of the night. I mean, he said it was just total harassment around the clock. And it was meant to wear people down. And in the movie, Marty Rathbun also explains some interesting strategies where they would track IRS people and their spending and expose them in magazine articles, whether it had anything to do with the church or not. The point was to make life miserable for the IRS. So finally, by 1991, under George H.W. Bush, there was an IRS commissioner named Fred Goldberg. And one day in 1991, David Miscavige and Marty Rathbun just showed up at his office without an appointment and said, "We want to see him." And Scientology denies this today, but they bragged about it at one time. And they let him in, and Marty's told me about this meeting where they sat with Goldberg. You have to understand, this harassment had been going on for years, around the clock. And at one point, Goldberg asked them, well, if we could work out something, you know, or Miscavige had said something like, if we work out something, some kind of, you know, settlement, all these lawsuits will go away overnight. And Marty said that Goldberg came up to him individually when the meeting was breaking up, and he said, is that accurate? Will that happen? And Marty said, yeah, they'll just go away overnight. And he said the guy's shoulders just like sank, like he was done. And so what Fred Goldberg then did is he announced a study to be done. Now, I've talked to tax experts, tax journalists, and they tell me that even though that took another 2 years and they made Scientology submit all kinds of documents and go through hell, once Goldberg made that decision, it was basically a done deal. Now, it took until 1993. There was a new president, Bill Clinton, but this had all been worked out, and in October 1993, they signed the agreement that made all of Scientology tax exempt. I mean, even as Larry Wright was explaining in the movie, even the novels are tax exempt. I mean, it's an incredible surrender by the IRS. They forgave the billion-dollar tax bill. They had a huge celebration, which is really well shown in the movie. And ever since then, Scientology's been racking up money like crazy. And the reason is not just because they don't have to pay taxes, but, you know, the people that do the work for the church, the Sea Org members, they get paid $50 a week and they're working 112 hours.
See, I don't understand this. You've written about this extensively. I just don't see why anyone would stick around, especially that $50 a week, you can't live on that.
Right.
And it's a slave labor.
Keep in mind, Scientology is constantly doing outreach, running ads everywhere, setting up tables in public places. Even with all of that hard work, only a small number of people are tempted at all to get into Scientology. Out of the people that are tempted to get into Scientology, a lot of them will just drop out after a month, okay? But a certain percentage of those people will stick around. Out of those people, another small percentage will get so into it, they decide this is the answer. This is what mankind needs to do to salvage this planet. And once somebody gets that convinced and they decide that Scientology has the answers, and all, if you go through the coursework, which I have done course by course at my website, you can see how every course is intended to build up this idea that Scientology has all of the answers and your eternity is only going to be assured through Scientology and you have to be part of this effort. Once somebody, again, it might just be a minority of a minority, but once somebody buys into that idea and they come to you and say, look, you understand that this is the only way we're going to save this planet. We need you to work around the clock for us. And some people, that seems like an attractive adventure. Yeah, I'm ready to join. So they have you sign this contract literally for a billion years. The Sea Org contract. It actually says on it, a billion-year contract. Because, again, the idea is you come back and back and back in more lifetimes, and so you're pledging all these lifetimes. And they often go after very young people that really probably aren't prepared to make this kind of a decision. I've talked to people who signed their billion-year contract when they were only 6 or 7 years old. Laura DiCrescenzo, who I've been writing about, joined the Sea Org at 11 or 12 years old. At 12 years old, she was working 98-hour weeks. When she turned 13, they moved her up to an adult schedule, which is 112 hours a week. That's 7 days a week with only a few hours of sleep each night, and they take home 40 or 50 bucks. So it works out to, what, 40 cents an hour. And they get no days off ever. They don't never have a day off. They have a few hours off on Sunday to take care of things like getting their toiletries together for the week. And, I mean, I talked to a guy that hadn't seen his mother in 9 years because she was a Sea Org member and she never has a day off. So the dedication is incredible. But again, by the time people have joined the Sea Org, they've bought into this idea that this is the only adventure that counts. I mean, if this is what's going to save the universe, how could you not dedicate yourself to it completely? That's the thinking that goes into it. Now, whether that's mind control or hypnotism, I'm not an expert in that. There's some academics that will debate about that. I think there is definitely some hypnotism going on in auditing. But people sign that contract every day. And it's very scary. And see, a lot of what Scientology is about is creating this idea that leaving is the worst thing you could possibly do. Mark Headley has talked about how, you know, he was a Sea Org worker at the international base. And they were told that, you know, what would you be going to if you left? You wouldn't, you know, most of them don't go to college. Most of them drop out of high school to get into the Sea Org. They're told you will struggle just to have a job at McDonald's. That's what they're told. You will have a hard time surviving. Why do you want to go out there? You have room and board here. You get paid $50 a week. Room and board there means that you're sharing in a typical berthing apartment for the Sea Org. There will be, say, 3 bedrooms, and there will be 4 people in each bedroom. This is why Sea Org members tend to get married very young. Is the only way you can get any privacy is by getting married. And so you have these 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds getting married, because then they get to move to the married berthing, where at least you have your own room. You're still not going to have your own apartment, but a married couple gets each room. So, you know, I remember one time I said Sea Org members only get paid $50 a week. And somebody said, how do they live? I said, they get room and board. And somebody says, oh, well, they get room and board. Well, it's, believe me, it's not luxury. So it's kind of a puzzle why people get into that. But some do.
I just want to stop you there for a minute and explain briefly for listeners who don't know what Sea Org is.
Right. So Hubbard started in Dianetics in the United States, and it was very popular here at first. And then he ended up in Phoenix to regroup and make Scientology. So he was building up organizations around the world, but he was based in the United States. But it was getting, you know, he was getting harassed a lot by the government. And so in 1959, he went to England, and he was very successful there for several years. It was he had this thing called St. Hill Manor, which is this estate in East Grinstead, England. Very large numbers of young people coming there from around the world to get processing, making a ton of money. But then he, you know, the British government started to get unhappy about it and looking into it. So by 1966, he realized he had to leave there. And it, you know, he realized that any government was going to look into his activities. So, I mean, he was a Navy veteran from World War II. So what he did in 1966 was he got a small number of ships and literally took Scientology to the sea. 3 ships that ended up, the one that he was the Commodore on was called the Apollo. And he literally ran this worldwide organization from this ship. And it was mostly spending time in the Mediterranean at first, and then it was out in the Atlantic. And they would go to a port, like in Greece, and try to make a big splash. And then they'd get kicked out of there eventually. Then they had to go to another port. Anyway, he had a few hundred young people with him, helping him to run these 3 ships as they went around the Mediterranean. And they became known originally as the Sea Project, and then it got named the Sea Organization. L. Ron Hubbard and the Sea Organization ran Scientology from the sea from 1966 until 74. He first wanted to come back to the United States, but then he heard that there were federal agents waiting for him in South Carolina. So he spent an additional year down in the Caribbean. And finally, in 1975, they came back to land and invaded Clearwater, Florida, under a fake name, the United Churches of Florida. Once they came back to land, however, they kept all of the naval paraphernalia. They still called themselves the Sea Org. The base in Clearwater is literally called Flag Land Base because the Apollo used to be the flagship, see? So they still wear naval uniforms. They call themselves captain and lieutenant. They look, you know, hilarious. But and to this day, they call themselves Sea Organization, even though they're no longer a sea.
Tony, you read the book Dianetics, which is pretty amazing. I've seen the book, and that's probably a tough read, but you did it as the sacrificial lamb for your readers on the blog. Can you summarize that book for us?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, you have to read Dianetics if you want to report about Scientology, and it's a tough slog. It's a very strange book. But this is when, 1950, Hubbard announces that he's discovered the true nature of the mind, and it's got two halves. The analytical side, which is this perfect recording computer, but it's held back by the reactive side, which takes over when you're unconscious and records all your traumatic memories that then mess you up for the rest of your life. And he then proposes these counseling techniques that will help you remember those traumatic experiences. And by remembering them, then you lessen their power. And again, I will say, I don't think there's any doubt that there's something to the idea of sitting down with another person, talking about the troubles you've had in your life, you will feel better. But he claims that there's this whole mechanism that these traumatic memories are stored in what he calls engrams in the protoplasm of cells. He changed this later because it was so obviously unscientific. But his counseling would remove these engrams, and within maybe 20 to 100 hours of counseling, you would be clear. The reactive mind would be gone. You'd have all these superhuman effects. That's what Dianetics says. He immediately started coming out with more books to make it much more complicated, add more layers. It was going to take much longer to be clear. But Dianetics has that basic idea of going clear through counseling. Along the way, he is claiming that the most powerful engrams, the most powerful traumatic memories, occur when you are a sperm, egg, or zygote in the womb. And you are somehow supposed to be able to go back into your memory and remember those events. And a lot of his examples have to do with your parents having rough sex or your mother's stomach being knocked because your dad was knocking her around. And what they said at that moment then was recorded by your mind and messes you up 40 years later. I mean, it's ludicrous. But people in 1950 thought this was a really interesting idea, and they actually formed clubs to help each other remember what they went through in the womb. And they actually capture this really well in the movie The Master. They actually have some scenes showing people trying to remember what it was like as just a little fetus. Nobody in the scientific community took any of this seriously at all. But it had, like Larry Wright said, it was kind of a psychological folk art. It was popular. But that's what the book is. It's hard to read. It's got a lot of – it's actually very misogynistic, and – he assumed that every woman made multiple attempts at abortion in each pregnancy. He had very strange ideas about women and their pregnancies. It's a very odd book. I read the first edition for my blogging exercise. I don't think they've changed it all that much. I think if you grabbed a new copy off the shelf today, you would find all these really strange examples about abortion attempts, men beating up women, your mother having problems on the toilet causing you problems 40 years later in your life. I mean, really strange stuff. But of course, Scientology never actually talks about the specifics in the book. They always say things like, just read the book, it'll help you with your communication. But, it's really a very odd book.
Thanks for reading it for all of us. That's something that...
It was a slog, let me tell you.
I can imagine. The current leader of Scientology, David Miscavige, he's a very interesting individual. You've described him a number of ways in your blog, and he's got a very interesting relationship with some of the top celebrities, including Tom Cruise, and his wife is missing. Can you give us a rundown on this individual?
All right, David Miscavige is from South Philly. His dad got him into Scientology because his dad was concerned about the asthma that David had, and they were hoping that Scientology might be able to help him with it. Ended up going over to England to take the high-level courses, and at first David was a prodigy as an auditor. He was auditing people at a very young age. Eventually came back to the United States and ended up in California where Hubbard was. At that time, in 78 or so, I think, Hubbard was in semi-seclusion at a ranch in the California desert, and he was making films. He was making training films. And this young guy, David Miscavige, ended up being like his assistant camera guy. And Hubbard liked him for whatever reason. And so Miscavige, he was one of the young, what they called Commodore messengers. Most Commodore messengers were women, but he was one of the young teenage male Commodore messengers. And he just worked his way up. He was just totally dedicated to Hubbard, totally dedicated to Scientology. And a few years later, when Hubbard went totally into seclusion in 1980, he went into hiding with a young couple named Pat and Annie Broker. And Hubbard still wanted to run Scientology, even though he was in hiding. So he would send his messages to Pat Broker, who would secretly meet with Miscavige, and Miscavige would then take Hubbard's words to the rest of the Scientology world. So you can see that Pat Broker and David Miscavige were in a very powerful position because they were kind of the choke point between Hubbard and the rest of the world. And Miscavige took advantage of that, so that while Hubbard was in total seclusion, Miscavige was building up his power as the real ruler of Scientology. And then Hubbard died in 86, and by that time, Miscavige was fully in control, even though he was only about 25 years old. So today he's only, you know, he's still only 54 years old. He runs this worldwide organization with an iron fist. He micromanages the entire thing. He's been accused of beating his underlings and ripping apart families and just being a ruthless tyrant. But one of the most interesting details about him is that he made his wife disappear almost 10 years ago now. He was married to a woman named Michelle Barnett, who was known as Shelley Miscavige. And Shelley was a top executive in her own right. She was very much a tough Sea Org, you know, executive that helped Miscavige run Scientology. They went everywhere together. And then suddenly in 2005, Miscavige went away from the Hemet base to Los Angeles, and Shelley stayed behind. And I've talked to people who were there at the time, that it was really unusual. Something was going on. And there was some problem going on in their relationship. I've heard this from a number of people. And while Miscavige was gone, Shelley took care of a couple of things that had never had been able to get taken care of while Miscavige was around. One of which was called an org board. It's like this list of jobs and postings that never seemed to get done right. And she just took care of it while he was gone. Also, he wanted his quarters renovated, but he'd never moved his stuff out. So she had his stuff moved out. She was basically taking care of things that had never gotten taken care of. He came back from LA, saw what she had done, and he just erupted. And I've got eyewitnesses to this, that he just went ballistic. And about a week later, she vanished. And this was about September 2005. And she's basically never been seen since. In the summer of 2007, she was allowed out from where she was being held to attend the funeral of her father. And that's it. Since 2005, that's the only time she's been seen. Now, I know where she is. The international base in Hemet, where the hole was, is fairly secretive, but it's not that secret. People know, you know, who's working there and what's going on there generally. But there's a whole other set of compounds that Scientology has that are totally secret. Most Scientologists don't even know about them. And they're called the Church of Spiritual Technology, CST. It's this secretive group inside of a secret group. And very few people are part of it. They're very quiet about it. They have a compound up near Lake Arrowhead, above them in the mountains above Los Angeles. And I'm convinced she was sent up there. What they do at CST is they do this archiving project where they're taking all of Hubbard's words and lectures, and they want to preserve them forever. So they dig these vaults. They have one at the Lake Arrowhead compound. They've got one in Northern California, a couple in Northern California. They've got one in New Mexico, and they're building one in Wyoming. And in these underground vaults that are supposed to be nuclear war-proof, they store things like Hubbard's lectures on gold laser discs and his written words on stainless steel plates that are held in titanium banker boxes with inert gases. Now, all of this was designed in the early 80s. In the early 80s, they didn't foresee by 2015 you could basically record everything Hubbard ever did on a thumb drive, right? And you don't need to dig vaults to keep his words alive. But whatever, they're dedicated to it. And so she went up there and she's been working on the archive project. And I've been told that she's also worked on some other church initiatives, like this new golden age of technology phase two thing. So is she a prisoner up there? Is she there on her own will? This is a tough question. When Leah Remini left Scientology in the summer of 2013, she had wondered what had happened to Shelley.
The actress?
Leah Remini, the actress from King of Queens. And she had been a Scientologist since she was 6 years old, basically grew up in it. And it's a long story why she left. But basically, she left in the summer of 2013, and she, you know, was wondering, where is Shelley? And the lieutenant told me that these two detectives met with Shelley. She was okay. She said she didn't want to say anything publicly. Well, that's all they can do with a missing persons report. They can't, like, you know, they can't, like, pull her out of there or anything like that. So Leah reported that on a Monday. I found out about it on a Wednesday night. I reported it Thursday morning on my website. By Thursday afternoon, the LAPD was telling reporters, no, 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 this is an unfounded report. Well, I asked Lieutenant Dawson later. I said, can you at least tell me if when these two detectives met with Shelley and talked to her, were they in the presence of other church officials? And the lieutenant's answer was, that's classified. So, you know, the question then becomes, is she there on her own will? You know, Tom DeVaught actually answers this really interestingly in the movie. They ask him about a separate kind of prison situation Scientology has. And he said the problem with the idea of rescuing someone like that is if the FBI showed up and said, hey, Shelley, you can come out, she might say, I'm here under my own will, you know? I mean, you know, it's amazing that David Miscavige has been able to disappear his wife. But she may be resigned to her fate.
Tony, with all your work in investigative journalism about Scientology, and I know you get asked this all the time, why haven't you been affected by Scientologists? Why haven't they gone after you, or have they?
I usually don't like to talk about it. I get asked that question all the time, and I just said, look, anytime you write regularly about Scientology, they have a strategy for that, and I usually don't give any details. For Alex Gibney, though, I mean, when Alex Gibney asks you about it, you know, I did tell him some things, and they're in the movie about, you know, some harassment that I've experienced, and it's just a small part of what I've been through. And I don't like to talk about it because I don't want to give them, you know, I think they get off on it when you talk about what they've put you through. There's a risk to writing about Scientology, and I know some reporters recently have said that there's no longer any danger. And it's just not true. I mean, particularly with this movie coming out, there's been a lot of harassment, not of me recently, but some of the other people in the film have been through a lot of harassment. The person that went through the most legendary harassment of all times was an author named Paulette Cooper, who wrote one of the first books about Scientology in 1971. And her experiences are legendary, and I decided that that was the one most interesting story that hasn't been told fully. And so I worked with Paulette, and I tracked down other people that were there then, and that's what my book is about. It's called The Unbreakable Miss Lovely, and I called it that because in Scientology documents where it was documented how they framed her and harassed her and tried to destroy her, they would refer to her as Miss Lovely. So we've used that as the title of the book. It's coming out in May. Paulette and I together are going to be making some appearances around the country, and I hope people enjoy it.
Tony Ortega, the executive editor of The Raw Story, former editor of The Village Voice. Your work, extensive work, can be found at tonyortega.org. Thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Hey, man, thank you for having me on. This has been fun.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again on Dark Matter Radio.